The key distinction we need to make is on whether AI is helping you become more differentiated, or is it helping you become more commoditized, or is it driving you towards more commoditization? And depending on where you lie on that spectrum, the outcome on your skill premium will vary a lot.
Welcome to the Amplifying Cognition podcast. I am Ross Dawson, a futurist and entrepreneur fascinated by the unlimited potential of the human mind. In this podcast, we learn from amazing people how to think better and build better organizations in our massively accelerating world. We explore what's possible, how to augment ourselves, and ultimately, who we can become. We also build platforms and tools to help people amplify their cognition. These include the Humans Plus AI Explorers community, where pioneers share how they are augmenting their capabilities with AI, my AI-enhanced thinking and decision-making cohort course, which goes deep into these practices and how they're applied, and our ThoughtWeaver app for AI-augmented thinking workflows. To find out about these, my corporate work, or to access our newsletter and free book chapters and many other free resources, just go to amplifyingcognition.com. In this episode, I speak with Sangeet Paul Chowdhury. Sangeet is the founder of Platform Thinking Labs and co-author of Platform Revolution, which has sold over 300,000 copies, and author of two other leading books on platform strategy. He is a keynote speaker and advisor to major organizations worldwide, and is a World Economic Forum Young Global Leader. Sangeet's work has been featured on four occasions in the HBR Top 10 Must Reads collection. This episode is rather different from our usual podcast conversations. In this case, I invited Sangeet onto the podcast, and he pointed to some recent articles he'd written centered around this theme of AI won't eat your job, but it will eat your salary. So I responded that I didn't quite agree with that. So we agreed to make it a debate. And essentially, Sangeet lays out his case, and I sometimes have different views, but part of the themes are essentially this ideas of skill premium. How much more you make for having superior skills, and whether or not that's going down, the ability of AI to increase the earning capacity or skills of lower skilled people, and many themes around polarization. So fairly deep discussion of AI and the future of work, something which we can't know, but it was wonderful to have a great conversation with Sangeet, and be interested to know what you think at the end of it. Sangeet, it's wonderful to have you on the show.
Thank you, Ross. It's such a pleasure to be here.
So we could talk about any number of things, but you've been writing recently about the future of work, I suppose, specifically the impact of AI on skill premium. And I have some probably somewhat different views here. So perhaps we can frame this a little bit as a, well, maybe not a debate, but a discussion. So perhaps, first of all, you can sort of lay out at a high level your case, and I can sort of perhaps bring some other perspectives to bear as we go.
Sure, absolutely. My interest in, the role of or the impact of technology on the future of work sort of started with the rise of platforms. So the first thing that we saw with the rise of platforms was that we saw new ways to organize work in markets. And Uber and the gig economy is a great example of this. When work gets extremely commodified, right? When you think of a driver whose natural advantage, apart from the license that they had for the taxi, was their ability to navigate the city and just their knowledge of the city. And Google Maps comes in, GPS comes in, and that commoditizes that particular knowledge. Now, suddenly, anybody without that level of depth about navigating the city can become a driver. That essentially shows how centralized market making of a commoditized skill. The more a skill gets commoditized, the more it lends itself to a centralized market making where the right resource can be allocated to the right problem. That's essentially what happens in gig economy platforms, and Uber being an extreme example, where you don't really care who's coming to take you from point A to point B. It's just a resource being allocated to a problem. Now, so the idea that kind of came out of that work, which I conducted with the ILO Future of Work Commission, was that the more skills get commoditized, the more they lend themselves to centralized market making. And the more the skills are commoditized, the more agency and power, especially in terms of setting your price and a premium on your skill, moves away from you to the platform that's kind of making that allocation. And broadly speaking, markets exist everywhere. It's not just Uber, but even if you're working in an organization, you're constantly being matched to opportunities. There's an internal market. If you're a freelancer, you're obviously in an external market, but markets exist everywhere. That's just the nature of the networked world we live in. So the essential idea over there to start with is that markets are everywhere. Centralized market making is a thing. And secondly, the more a skill is commoditized, the more it lends itself to centralized market making.
Well, actually, just bouncing off that for starters. So of course, the key point there is fungibility, as in, you know, one unit of labor can be replaced by another unit of labor, or the substitutability. And as you suggest, there is this tussle where people are looking to distinguish themselves in some form, so, and be able to charge a premium, and the platforms would encourage. And the more they can get this idea of fungibility, anybody can be substituted by anyone else, the better. So we've seen, of course, there are a number of tiers to the work platforms. So going from ones which are truly fungible, from a lot of the mechanical Turk type roles to driver type roles. And, you know, and again, there's some degree of differentiation in terms of how, you know, friendly or clean or whatever the car is. But going through to where there are still a, you know, plenitude of expert platforms of various guises, where people are not fungible. And we go through the different tiers of, you know, from low level through to mid tier skills through to high level skills. And these become a ways to be able to access people with significant skills. So even if you are, you know, there's probably some people who would, you know, not necessarily be on those platforms, but arguably, for example, a talent agency. So if you look at the major Los Angeles, you know, talent agencies, these are, in a sense, platforms. And it's only through those platforms you can access the major George Clooney's or the other stars of this world. So those are, you know, of course, you've got other ones such as, you know, Gerson Lehman Group, which has some degree of, you know, fair bit of replaceability. So there is these pushes where people are trying to get more fungibility or substitutability, but that's not necessarily the best for the economy or society as a whole, and many people are pushing back about it. But I do agree that the force towards the commoditization of those skills is still pretty strong.
Yeah, so I think, you know, there's a whole spectrum in terms of how commoditized work is, which is why I called out, you know, there's centralized market making and there's the degree to which work is commoditized. There are two aspects to this, and I'm going to just park one aspect very quickly and then go towards the other, which lends more itself in the direction of the topic of AI. But the first piece is just this, that even in highly differentiated work, there are a lot of factors that determine your ability to charge a skill premium and to what extent that premium is proportional to your skill. My argument there, which I've shown with a lot of evidence as well, is that because there's a superstar effect that takes place, the higher you are rated, the more likely you are to get future work, and hence the more likely you are to get higher ratings as well. There's a feedback loop that isolates a set of superstars within highly specialized work, but the vast majority of non-superstars kind of languish in the middle, and the difference between the middle and the superstar is typically a factor of 10x. It's not a factor of 1.5x. And the additional issue that comes with this is that there's an arbitrariness to this inequality. If you're early to a platform, the feedback loops can work in your favor much longer. You can be featured on lists that are promoted by the platform much earlier. You know, Twitter, if you were an intern at Twitter in 2007, you were most likely to be part of People You Should Follow list when it came out. And all those interns today have 500,000 followers on Twitter, not because they are necessarily thought leaders, but because they were at the right place at the right time. So there are all of these factors, arbitrary inequalities, which get, amplified because of feedback loop. So that's one part of the argument, that even in terms of the highly specialized work, because of the mechanized nature of reputation systems, they are not necessarily meritocratic. But on the other side, where this argument moves towards AI is that just like GPS and Google Maps commodified my knowledge of the city as a driver, new technologies, especially AI, commoditize a lot of different skill sets and move what is today highly specialized labor into highly commoditized labor over time. And as that shift happens, so I think the key assumption or the key distinction we need to make is on whether AI is helping you become more differentiated, or is it helping you become more commoditized, or is it driving you towards more commoditization? And depending on where you lie on that spectrum, the outcome on your skill premium will vary a lot. And independent of where you are on that spectrum, networks will play a role as well, and I'll come back to that. So my point about AI is this, that AI is fundamentally different for two reasons. One is that what's similar to AI versus previous technologies is that there's augmentation. When there's augmentation, you can up-level, but very often what happens is that the lower-skilled workers are able to up-level to a higher level of mediocre performance, and the higher-skilled workers are not able to command that premium anymore. And we've seen that with previous technological cycles.
Well, just on that point, I mean, it's not all studies have shown that. There are certainly, you know, notably the BCG study and a couple of others have shown this effect that generative AI had improved the performance of lower performing people more than those of higher people. But there are other studies, such as a recent one on, you know, super forecasting prediction, where there was no differentiation between higher and lower performers. And I think others where they have shown that there has increased. So I think whilst it depends on the whilst the jury is still out, as in there's still relatively early data, and also I think it depends very much on the type of the task. So, for example, writing tasks, I think it's fairly evident that, you know, if you're already very skilled, it's not going to improve you much. Whereas if you're not a very skilled writer, generative AI will help you substantially. And there are a number of tasks like that. But as we move into more sophisticated tasks, then I believe that there is more potential. So, for example, take for strategic decision making. If you are a highly skilled strategic decision maker and you are able to use generative AI effectively, you know, whilst it's very difficult to measure the impact of that, I would, you know, make the case that it's far harder for a less skilled person to be able to use these tools effectively to increase their capabilities, because they don't even have a foundation for understanding how and where those would be applied.
Yeah, and these are fair points. And my point is not, you know, my point about less skilled workers benefiting more versus more skilled workers is not an AI point. It's a technology point in general. You know, we've seen that since the time that, you know, chainsaws replaced axes and so on. It's a more generic point, and I absolutely agree that there are certain types of tasks where, or certain types of skills which will be augmented towards better performance, and certain types of skills where the lesser workers will move further. That leads us to a different point, which is, you know, where do you lie in this talent versus labor spectrum? Because in any economy, depending on what kind of skills are valued, talent ends up being closer to, you know, seeing gains that are closer to the gains on capital, versus labor ends up becoming commodified over time. And so with every new form of technology that comes in, what ends up happening is that what is classified as labor fundamentally changes. Even if I go back to the Uber example, you have capital, which is venture capital. You have talent, which are the engineers at Uber, but their returns are closer to capital than to labor. And then they're the drivers who are really labor. And so with AI, again, we need to ask the question, you know, are you talent? Are you labor? Are you going to be part of the value chain where AI is going, where you're going to work on top of AI, versus are you going to be part of the value chain where it's going to eat up certain aspects of your work?
So just to sort of interject there just for a moment as well, I mean, back to your early point around essentially polarization. So the polarization of value and work has been well demonstrated. David Autor and a lot of others have shown that in over decades and in different contexts and in different industries and in different geographies, that we do have experience of polarization of work. And there's a whole array of factors behind that. But part of that, overlaid with that, is the allocation of value between labor and capital. And essentially, you know, that disconnected around 1970-ish, and well, in the US market in particular, where we started to see the accruals of labor productivity going to capital as opposed to labor. And so whether that is a function of technology or whether that is a factor of a whole array of managerial decisions overlaid with government policy or other factors, which have meant, again, power, you know, essentially the ability to superior bargaining power, negotiating power in that situation, has been able to extract a greater share of value from increased labor productivity. That's not necessarily a function of technology.
And that's precisely my point. My point is not labor versus capital, it's labor versus talent. To the extent that talent extracts value from technology, it is able to position itself closer to capital, because capital needs to allocate itself towards maximizing the returns on technology. And talent is the mechanism through which those returns are maximized. So I fully agree that the capital versus labor polarization is Reaganomics and is all those economic macroeconomic factors and decisions that were taken around the 70s to 80s. But especially in the information economy, the way to maximize the returns on capital has been by maximizing leverage of technology. And that's where talent comes in. And so the question really is, which side of the technology spectrum do you fall on? Do you end up becoming commoditized labor? Do you end up becoming a mechanism through which the returns on technology can be maximized? So that's the key idea, which then essentially takes us to another aspect, which is that AI, unlike previous technologies, is self-learning. And that then starts having an impact on talent as well, because one of the advantages of talent has been learning advantages. A lot of what we consider labor, and we moved far from the traditional blue-collar, white-collar distinction that used to be there. That's a very industrial distinction. The talent versus labor distinction, to a large extent, is to what extent does a learning advantage lead to an improvement in your skill premium? And what AI again does is it attacks that learning advantage, because AI is a learning technology as well.
Not necessarily, in the sense of, to your point and what you're right, I mean, the key point is the degree of substitutability or complementarity of technology to human roles. So in some cases, if it is substituting tasks within broader roles, then that is clearly being able to reframe the original role. Others, if it can act as a complement, then augments the value created in that role. So this, from there, we... one of the frames here is around, this is not a steady state system terms of there being defined roles or defined ways in which values are created. So as we start to see an evolution of value creation in the economy, evolution of what the or function of organizations for the roles of humans, those start to be complemented by AI in different ways. So it's not a human.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, the thing is that we are gradually building out this thesis as we go through this conversation. I mean, I'm neither claiming that that's a static. The pie is not fixed. The pie keeps changing. How that pie gets distributed keeps changing as well. And so the distinction in terms of where you land in terms of talent versus capital becomes important. Now, where you land in terms of talent versus capital has two more aspects to it. One, going back to the point, when technology impacts jobs, jobs are a bundle of tasks. And when technology impacts jobs, most technologies typically substitute certain tasks. Now, to the extent that those tasks enabled you to command a skill premium, because you end up doing a lot of things at work, not everything is what you're paid for. Some of those things are just, business as usual. To the extent that those tasks do not impact your ability to charge a skill premium, you can rebundle around the other tasks and continue to charge a skill premium or even up level. But to the extent that they do, that is where, if you're a writer and you're primarily being paid to write content and you're not being paid so much to send emails to a large extent or attend meetings, and to a large extent, your primary skill premium enhancing task has been impacted, you need to immediately start thinking, well, how do you rebundle? Maybe there's advantage now not in the writing in itself, it's in the followership that I've gained, it's in the relationships that I have, it's in the unique insight that I have about a particular issue. So that rebundling is key. So what's really important is, if you look at your job bundle, your job is a bundle of tasks, where are you charging a skill premium and what's the impact of AI on that? Is it enhancing that? Is it substituting that? I think that becomes a key aspect over here.
Taking a very quick break, this podcast is just one facet of our work to amplify human cognition. If you're interested in thinking better in a world of overload, using AI to augment yourself, finding like-minded thinkers, or improving your organization's performance, just go to amplifyingcognition.com. We'll find a wealth of free resources and useful tools. Now, back to the show. So one of the questions there is, well, who drives that rebundling? And so individuals can, you know, as you suggest, the writer may choose to present themselves in a different way or to find different ways to price for their work or whatever it may be. But organizations are now engaged in task reorganization, or as I think of it, as work redesign. So rather than sort of looking at current state and then saying, well, how do we rejig current roles and redefine the edges of those, to actually throw that entirely open, say, well, now we have, you know, analytic AI, generative AI, and a whole lot of talent, and we can reconfigure that. And part of that, being able to do that in ways where, you know, people are not doing things which are commoditizable, be they, you know, outsourced or given to low-cost people or done by generative AI, and where those start to emphasize that of generative AI. And coming back to the skill point, where even if AI continues to, you know, essentially gain skills or to learn on the job through all of its interactions, that's still still the human AI system, as it were, can continue to evolve, where the human is, you know, again, not static, as a generative AI is not static, and together can actually still maintain that ability to create value in conjunction with generative AI, similar fashion that it has before.
Yeah, well, the question really is how many humans remain in the system in order to generate the same amount of value. If you could keep a human in the system to get the human plus AI component, but instead of 10 humans, you're now able to achieve the same productivity with one human, what do you do with the remaining 9? They end up slipping from the talent bucket to the labor bucket. And what then ends up happening is, and we've seen this before in the previous cycles of unemployment that have happened. Once you have folks entering the labor bucket, there's a feedback loop that moves in that direction. Your access to learning reduces, your access to networking opportunities reduces, your access to just generating a premium on any skill reduces. And so that's one issue that comes in. The other piece, your point is very valid. You know, who gets the right to the bundle? Within organizations, to a large extent, the right to the bundle is determined to determined by the level of voting power that you can accrue in your favor. And what I mean by voting power is that if you think of your job as a bundle of tasks or even as a bundle of goals, you are constantly participating in different teams, contributing to their goals. If your contribution in a team gets replaced by technology substituting your position in that team, because that's the final thing I want to talk about. AI is unique because AI agents are goal seeking. They are not just task substituting. They can even combine tasks towards goals. So agents are the fundamental unit of rebundling in AI, rebundling tasks back to goals. And then goals are rebundled inside teams towards higher level goals. So if you were achieving a certain goal in a certain team and an agent can replace you, and there are a lot of factors depending on, you know, based on which we can determine whether an agent can replace you, happy to go into those as well. But then the question that comes in is your voting power that accrues to you reduces because now you have one less team voting in your favor or in favor of your role. And so over time, these factors start having a feedback effect because of which even if you retain certain roles, your ability to command a premium internally within an organization may go down over time. And so these are at this point still hypotheses to be very fair. These are hypotheses that, you know, we're validating at two different levels. What we're talking about is at the abstract. I personally apply AI in a lot of my work. I see my productivity increasing big time. So I can see how, apply it in the right way. And if you are able to, because I have agency in my work and in my workflow, if you're able to rebundle your workflow around AI, just as an example, I don't see the advantage of AI in writing. I see the advantage of AI in brainstorming, providing it a few different inputs and then working around that and building new ideas. That, in effect, reduces my, you know, my time to get creative because there's less of staring at a blank paper and more of brainstorming that's been happening at the back end. So depending on what your bottlenecks are in your work, if you can use AI to resolve those bottlenecks, if you can use AI to uplevel your skills around those bottlenecks, I think that those are ways in which you can augment yourself towards greater productivity. So as I said, there's an abstract place at which we're framing these hypotheses. And we need to keep gathering evidence of how people are actually using it at the very specific level as well.
Yes. Yeah. Well, as you say, these are all hypotheses, and hopefully by the nature of these kinds of conversations beginning to shape the way in which we want things to go, as well as obviously discovery, because these are very deep uncertainties. Now, I want to come back to the AI agents piece, and because I think that's a deeper and very important topic. But just going back, I think there's a couple of reframes. One is this idea of demand elasticity for productivity. So there are some roles where you don't need more. Once you've got a certain amount, let's say coffees, once you've had enough coffee, you've had enough coffee, and you don't need more skills and be able to create a wonderful coffee. So the demand elasticity is high. Whereas there are some other things, and I think a good example is software program or software development, in the broader sense, so not underlying skills such as coding, where the amount of software which we've managed to develop up to date is a tiny fraction of what we could and we will, and which could create superior value. So the issue then becomes, well, it's not as if we have one programmer or one software developer 10x's their productivity, so you don't need another 9. Then maybe one can multiply by 10, one can multiply by 2, whatever it may be. And all of this, because it is essentially fully demand elastic for what it is they create, then you can continue both to generate more value supported by generative AI and continue to reward those people for that. And I think another overlay on this is also that the ability to attract talent. And crudely, you can have a leadership of a company be able to take two frames. One is, we have generative AI, which has significant capabilities. We will look to substitute as many of possible of our existing employees. Or you could have the other opposite of the spectrum and say, well, we have generative AI and we will look to complement to the highest possible degree all of our existing people. And I think it's fairly safe to say that the latter organization that looks to complement will find it far easier to attract talent.
If it is that straightforward, in the sense that it comes back to the talent versus labor divide, a lot of the things that you're talking about is essentially what applies to talent. And I'm not disagreeing or disputing that. It absolutely does apply to talent. And the definition of talent is the ability for capital to get a higher return on technology. So to the extent that humans can help capital gain a higher return on new technologies coming in, that's great. They will continue to survive in the talent spectrum, and they'll be able to capture all of the growing pie that's coming up. My key consideration is just this. Anecdotally, you can create a lot of arguments to support that talent will win, and absolutely it will. The question is, what percentage of the population is going to be talent and what percentage is going to be labor? If we have the last 10 years to go by, it is highly polarized in the with a very small fraction moving towards talent and a very large fraction increasingly moving towards labor. So the real question is that if you are able to grow the pie, but if the section of talent or the section of the working population that can be considered talent actually reduces, how do you then distribute or redistribute the spoils to labor? I think that's where it sort of breaks down. So I absolutely agree. And a lot of people listening to this podcast, I would argue, are probably thinking about these issues and trying to see how they can reframe their positioning on the talent side. So I'm not necessarily saying some of these issues apply to them. I don't agree that software engineering is going away. I do not agree with that at all. I think it's going to reform and position itself towards gaining greater returns on new technologies that come in. But forms of software engineering that do not help you do that will move towards labor. And the same thing applies to writing. The same thing applies to any skill. So my point of view here is just simply this. If you can, with every new shift in technology, if you can align yourself towards how you can generate higher returns on capital using your skill, not for yourself, but for the capital owners, you are part of talent. If you own some of the capital, then that's more power to you. But that's how I think about the talent versus labor divide over here.
Yeah, and I tell you, so as both you and I and everyone has seen, this reality of the polarization of labor has been continued, and the reality is, with a platform, network economy, long tail distributions, there are many factors which are pushing towards this polarization of value, unfortunately. And then many of the policies we need to enact are to be able to reduce that inequality. And so one of the pieces, and your articles make the case that skill premia will reduce. And I think, you know, that's plausible, but I suppose a lot of our discussion so far has been my argument that skill premia are maintained.
The skill premium is going to reduce for sure if you're going to move from talent to labor. If you're going to reposition yourself to talent, then it can be maintained. It can even grow. The question, my argument is more about the vast majority of the population that will inevitably move towards labor. And a large reason for that is the base at which technology is changing is not the base at which the larger population of humans is learning to reposition themselves. That's just the reality. Most people in this world are not listening to podcasts like this, are not thinking about issues like this. They are getting impacted and significantly shifting towards the labor side of the spectrum. To the extent that you move towards the labor side of the spectrum, I am fairly confident that the skill premium is going to reduce. We've seen that happen in multiple cycles of technology before. So really, the question is not whether the skill premium will reduce or increase. It's more about I won't even say which roles, because the concept of roles itself is fluid now, but who is going to land in labor and who's going to land in talent, and what kinds of skills give you the position to sit on the talent side of the spectrum, right? So if you're really good at selling, we've always seen if you can improve your ability to sell the advantages of new technology, you've now suddenly repositioned yourself to generate returns on that technology for capital that is invested towards it. So it's really about how do you keep protecting your position on the talent side and keep increasing over there. And the talent capital relationship, thanks to Silicon Valley, is very deeply ingrained. The more you position yourself on the talent side, the more you are in a position to gain some forms of capital over time. And so that segment of the population, I absolutely agree that it'll, if anything, the returns of AI will accrue in their favor. And in the long run, inequality will increase because most of the population will actually move on the labor side of the spectrum. So I think that's really the core of the argument, whether we believe that most of the population will move to labor versus talent, or whether we believe that most of them will reposition themselves as talent.
Yes. And, you know, I think if we, you know, from that frame, we can see that there's certainly, you know, it comes back to that question before around saying, do individuals do that for themselves? Do they rebundle or develop their own skills to be complementary to AI? And or do organizations or employers reframe that? And I think, you know, everyone has the opportunity, of course, to, you know, develop, complement their skills with AI for their own roles, or current or future roles. And the reality is a minority of organizations, but hopefully a significant proportion, will start to redesign work so that it does provide a scope for human capabilities, you know, to flourish, which I certainly believe it has a place for. But this comes back, you know, in a way, of course, to policy and to the ways in which it's framed to try to mitigate, you know, I think as we agree, this strong force for polarization of labor, or as you say it, from talent to labor, you know, people move from talent to labor. But overall, I mean, I still think that there is a decent case for, whilst with many challenges, the possibility at least of a prosperous future of work, broadly told.
For knowledge work, I think it's still open. But for it's really a question. So I think what I do not agree with is people saying consultants are going away or lawyers are going away just because ChatGPT is here. It's not going to be as binary and as deterministic as that. Instead, what we are going to see is that the skills that will help you generate higher returns on capital, for example, in consulting, the skill that helps you generate higher returns on capital are relationships and brand and the ability to own the outcome through some form of, you know, insurance. Nobody got fired for working with McKinsey and so on. And the ability to generate returns on that capital is not necessarily about creating decks. That's just part of the bundle. So AI can help you create decks, but if you own the brand, if you own the relationships, and if you own the ability to cover your clients' ass, you have the ability to actually extract a higher premium. So it kind of comes back to that. It's not as straightforward as saying this profession is going away or that profession is going away. You need to think about what's generating the returns on capital in a particular profession, and to what extent does your job control some of those factors on a day-to-day basis. That then helps you, it gives you the voting power to rebundle things in your direction or even have a say within the organization and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, part of your point draw out there is that, you mentioned, for example, relationships, which are fundamental in any network economy or ecosystem. And these are basically human capabilities. So there are, whilst our cognitive capabilities, I believe, will still be extremely important, even in a world of, extremely advanced AI, that there's many of those human factors and the fact that we do like to deal with humans that maintain a lot of that essentially pricing power.
Absolutely. And I'm not debating the fact that, it's not a human versus machine debate. It's a question of what kind of to what extent do relationships deliver the returns on capital. If you are a nurse taking care of an elderly at an old age home, that's not a relationship that's delivering superior returns on capital. So that job will continue to exist, but it will move into labor. But if you are somebody who's managing client relationships at a large law firm, that's a relationship that generates returns on capital. So it's really the place I think where we lose this debate is when we start thinking about machine versus human. I don't think that's the real debate. The debate is talent versus labor. And labor is essentially, any human work that does not generate higher returns on capital or generate supernormal returns on capital. And talent is any human work that does generate supernormal returns on capital. Eventually, all labor does generate returns on capital. I mean, that's what all the Uber drivers are doing. But they don't have the negotiating power to move that side of the pie in their direction. The supernormal returns are from the data scientists sitting at Uber. And so that is the distinction that I'm trying to make. That's what really matters. It's less about human versus machine and what's important. What are human skills versus not? There are a lot of human skills, and the nurse taking care of the elderly is just one great example of places where you will not be able to retain a higher pricing power just because you are highly substitutable despite your specific human skill.
I do think that we will value more human, distinctly human capabilities, such as relationships and caring and so on.
I fully agree with that.
If the economy prospers, as McKinsey and Andreessen Horowitz predict the boost of generative AI, that surplus or whatever, the way you frame that economy, I think many people will be choosing to spend that on people to be able to, in all sorts of ways, in terms of personal trainers or in terms of personal services or in terms of care or whatever. So I don't necessarily think that the pricing will push that down.
That's the distinction between value creation and value capture. I absolutely believe the personal trainers will create more value, but if somebody is willing to accrue the relation, the value back to the brand, that's where the value will move. So if you've seen anything in the digital economy, it is just this, that value creation does not sit with value capture. So I absolutely believe that human capabilities will generate a lot of value. I am highly skeptical that all of it will be captured in favor of the human capabilities.
Yes, I think through the, we could almost call it the tyranny of platform structures.
Sure.
So, I mean, we could continue a long time, but I think, I think we've given, I suppose, started at least a very good conversation and discussion on this topic. So where can people, I saw these articles on your Substack. So if you can tell people where to go to learn more about your research and writing on this.
Yeah, absolutely. The latest work that I publish is on my Substack. It's platforms.substack.com. And I also publish about it on my website. It's platformthinkinglabs.com. So these are two specific places where you can find my latest work in this topic.
Excellent. Thanks so much for your time and your insights, Sangeet. I think we should continue this conversation after you have a bit more data.
Absolutely. Look forward to it.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you want to dive deeper, access free downloads in our newsletter, and discover useful tools, go to amplifyingcognition.com. Did you enjoy this episode? Please support us by taking 30 seconds to give us a rating or a one-sentence review. Thank you, for your support. Thank you for listening, and have a wonderful day.